It's At the Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
Osuna's pitch. Ground ball hit out to short to his left, gloving it, going, throw it on to first. Ball game, Blue Jays 14-9 over Colorado. A first win in their history here in interleague play after going 0-7. What a sweet win it is. And the Blue Jays fans right now at the moment outnumber the Rockies fans. Who would have ever thought that here at Coors Field to end the game?
I mean, I don't know how you play 81 games here in one on the crew, you know, so it's not easy. I don't know how pitching staffs hold it up when this is your home team, because it's a totally different game than you're used to.
It's At the Letters for Wednesday, June 29th on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. My name is Arden Zwelling. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Ben Nicholson-Smith. What's going on, Ben?
Not a whole lot. It's, good to be talking some baseball. I feel like it's been a while since we saw a game as crazy as that Rockies-Blue Jays game with the hail and everything like that, but a little entertaining, I guess you could say, as well.
I'm sure you watched every second of it.
Yeah, bits and pieces. I was selective.
I stayed up. I had to watch it. You got to watch. Because I'm up till all hours in the morning anyway, so I just had baseball to keep me company now, which is nice. And it was also the most absurd baseball game that was ever played.
Yeah, just bizarre. I can't imagine. I know there were comments to this effect after the game, but can you imagine playing 81 times in Coors Field? Like, it's what a place to play a baseball game.
Oh, yeah. And I feel, and Coors Field is like a small part of what made that game like so insane.
Right.
But, you know, and I think Coors Field with like, and like, I'm sure like the playing surface was just like slick as hell. And, you know, I'm sure like the balls weren't really moving the way they should on the grass. And also, like, it's interesting when you just get baseball players out of their routine for like one night, you know, like, sorry guys, you're gonna have to wait 3 hours until the game starts. You get them out of their routine and all of a sudden it's just mayhem out there.
Yeah.
Like the errors, you know, like that's not Coors Field when, you know, the first baseman can't close his glove on a perfectly thrown ball.
Yeah. There was a lot of weird going on in that game. That's for sure. But I guess the Blue Jays were able to score a ton of runs, probably not uncommon in Coors Field when you have lineups like these two lineups, but it was enough to overcome, I guess, a relatively pedestrian outing from Hap.
Yeah, and you know what's going to be interesting is that today's game, Wednesday's game, is going to start exactly 12 hours after Tuesday night's / Wednesday morning's game ended.
Wow.
That game ended at 3:10 a.m. Eastern time, and you know, today's game starts 3:10 p.m. Eastern time. So I think there's definitely potential for more wackiness.
I think there's potential that some people sleep at the ballpark tonight. Because when you think about all the pregame prep and postgame routines, like, there's going to be very little time to get any sleep.
Shout out to the guy who washes the jerseys and cleans the cleats and the, you know, gets the gloves all ready, like organizes everything in the clubhouse, like stocks every guy's stall with his warm-up shirt and his warm-up shorts and, you know, the compression shorts that they really like and the weird socks. And the guy who has to do all that stuff, like, after the game, he didn't get to start until, you know, 3:30 a.m. our time here.
That's the guy who's not leaving the ballpark.
No.
That's the guy who's setting up a cot.
Yeah, exactly. Some of the, you know, thankless heroes of the Blue Jays world. So this is ATL. We're going to talk about Blue Jays baseball. What better place to start than on the bullpen, which is really what we've been talking about pretty much all year. Right when you think that things are going well, all of a sudden they're not again. And that's, you know, that's the volatility of bullpens. But I mean, really for the Blue Jays this year, the bullpen has just been, you know, it's been a wart all year long.
Yeah, it has. And I mean, losing Gavin Floyd, I think is a pretty big blow for the Blue Jays. Not that he was ever expected to be high leverage shutdown type arm. Not that he was even pitching like an elite reliever, but he was pitching like a solid reliever, the kind of guy that can help middle innings, help get you, you know, let's say it's 60, 70 innings in the course of a year, get some strikeouts. I think he was a pretty key piece for the Blue Jays for the first 3 months of the season. Now he's gone sidelined for, what was it, 8 to 12 weeks?
I mean, 8 to 12 weeks.
That's a long time.
Yeah,
that's,
well, you have 3 weeks, sorry, 3 months left in the season. You have 12 weeks left in the season,
yeah,
basically.
So there's a chance he would be back at the very end of the regular season or not at all.
A very good chance he's not back at all, I would say. And I think that what the Blue Jays got out of him for the $1 million that they spent on him, you got to be happy with that.
You have to be thrilled with that,
yeah,
for sure. And at the same time, though, you know, now someone else is going to have to step up. And I guess, is that Bo Schultz? Is it Ryan Tepera? You have a couple lefties coming back from the DL, but they need someone to step up.
Yes, absolutely. Right. You know, and Jesse Chavez is another guy who's been getting hit around a little bit lately. And I don't know how they're going to handle that, if they're going to back off of him a little bit or what. You know, Jesse, he said it's always interesting when you talk to Jesse Chavez because he's so in tune with the game and he understands like kind of the art of pitching so well. And he just gets what's happening. But then he just has he's had these runs this year where, you know, the ball, like the exit velocities are huge.
Yeah, he really has. And so that's left the Blue Jays going to other options in late innings. You go to Drew Storen, and just when it seems as though he's about to turn the corner, he hits two batters. He allows a couple hard hit balls. You know, he ends up allowing four runs in that game. The only out he records is a sacrifice bunt to a pitcher. And it's getting to the point now where, you know, Storen cannot retire lefties seemingly, and he's having trouble against righties. It's, you know, just at the time that he seemed to be gaining a little faith, I don't know how much confidence John Gibbons could have in it.
What was so good about Storen over those eight appearances where he didn't allow a run, he only allowed something like four hits. I mean, he was really, really good over those eight appearances, was he stopped trying to throw 95. Like, he stopped trying to be the guy that he once was, and he was learning to pitch with diminished velocity. So you saw a move from leaning on a four-seamer to leaning on a two-seamer, which has a bit more movement. He doesn't throw it as hard. That works off of, you know, his change up plays off of that, which kind of has similar movement, but there's like 7 miles per hour difference in velocity. So like you kind of use those to get some awkward swings, and then you can mix in the slider. It was working for him. And then kind of what I saw in that really bad outing, where he hit two batters, was he was trying to throw 95 again. And he kind of admitted it after the game. He said, yeah, I might've been trying to throw too hard. And you could see that he was overthrowing. That's how you hit two guys in a row. You know, you're yanking the ball. You're trying to throw too hard, and your location is gonzo.
And both guys he hit were in the left-handed batter's box.
Yeah.
So he really was yanking it, and he's trying to pitch with more velocity, but he's not. I mean, he's throwing 92. I mean, at this point, this isn't a small sample fluke. This is who he is this year. Yeah. He's a guy who throws 92.
It's we're 3 months in.
Yeah.
It's gone. So, and he was learning to pitch without that velocity. So it's very discouraging to see him kind of go back to that habit that he had, you know, picked up over the first month of the season.
I think they should let him build some momentum up by facing stretches of right-handed bats. He's right. Just having so much trouble against lefties that I think you use him against the bottom of the Royals order, the bottom of the Tigers order, stretches where you have all right-handed hitters.
Do you have that luxury if you're the Toronto Blue Jays when, you know, Gavin Floyd's down, Jesse Chavez is getting hit, Joe Biagini is, you know, mortal again?
I think you can create it a little bit where you go to Grilly, let's say, and Cecil in high leverage spots and, you know, hope for the best.
Right.
But realistically, the Blue Jays, I just don't see how Drew Storen's next appearance comes in a high leverage spot.
No, me neither. Yeah. I don't see, but I don't know how you're going to be able to protect him from lefties as much as you want to.
Exactly. And at a certain point, you need him to be effective against hitters on both sides of the plate. I mean more as like a stopgap.
Right.
Like, all right, this guy needs to build some momentum, and he has just like half the lefties he faces this year get on base. So just have him face righties for a week, 2 weeks, and see what, and go from there.
It's got to be tough because you think about your Drew Storen, he's making like $9 million this year. Coming out of last year, you know, if he had just continued his career norms, even just, you know, gotten a little bit worse, he still would have been setting himself up for a pretty big payday this winter. And now he's just, you know, with every outing, with every, you know, catastrophe, it's just hundreds of thousands of dollars are coming out of his pocket, are gone.
Yeah.
So he's dealing with that. He's dealing with the fact that he doesn't have the velocity that he once did. Like, imagine if, you know, you do your job for 8 years and you can do it really well, and then all of a sudden you just don't have a really key thing that allowed you to do your job well. Mentally, that'd mess you up.
It's crazy. It's free agency, very much a what have you done for me lately type of deal. And Storen had better have a strong couple months if he's going to get that contract that he was hoping for.
Another guy in that spot, Brett Cecil. Yep. Currently working his way back. He's in Buffalo right now. Obviously had a catastrophic beginning to the year and then went down to the torn lat. Now he's on his way back. He's looked good in Buffalo, but a lot of people can look good in Buffalo. Brett Cecil's, I don't know, I feel like he's far from a certain commodity right now.
Yeah.
Which is weird to say.
It is.
But he kind of is.
Yeah. I think that with Cecil, you know, it would be so much easier to ease him into a high leverage role if the Blue Jays had other relievers who were pitching well. As it stands now, I almost think that they're going to go to him in these big spots almost from the get-go. Maybe not the very first outing, but I think that within a couple of days, he's probably going to be called on in those big spots because they simply don't have other relievers who are capable of getting to Osuna.
In a certain way, he has earned that rope in a way. You know, when you think about his last 3 years coming into this one, I mean, just so good. ERAs in the twos. There's an all-star appearance in there somewhere. Like, he was really, really, really good. He had that crazy run last year after Father's Day. Didn't allow Aaron to run for every many in a row. But, you know, you can kind of just trace this thing back to in the playoffs last year, he tears his calf, right? And you know, he's working to come back from that, and he was throwing. You know, he wanted to pitch in the World Series. The Blue Jays got there. And then, you know, he goes to the offseason, he's got to rehab that thing, and he gets back on the mound, and you wonder if maybe he compensated for it a little bit, and maybe that's how the lat thing happened. Like, you know, like, totally speculating, but like, maybe that, you know, when one thing on your body isn't working the right way, other parts of your body have to compensate for it and have to, you know, take on that workload. So maybe that affected him earlier this year when he couldn't spot his curveball and couldn't put his curveball where he wanted it to be. Maybe that's something to do with the lat, which had something to do with the calf, which, you know, like, it's kind of like a domino effect in a way.
For sure. I think it definitely could be. And so even if he's able to come back, you've got, say, two really good relievers in Osuna and Cecil. And then after that, you're kind of piecing it together with the likes of Grilly, Chavez, Storen, Biagini. So to you, what's the level of need in that bullpen? As far as, you know, we're almost in July. Like, it's getting to that time of year where you kind of look around at the trade market. Do you think that need is like really pressing, somewhat pressing?
Yeah. I mean, it's been pressing from day one of the season, really, when you look at it. Like, right? Like, from at no point this year have I said, yeah, no, that bullpen's good.
You know, I thought there was a period like a week or two ago where you thought, okay, Cecil and Sanchez are going to be moving there. Yeah. So you're almost not going to have room for all these guys. And so I might have said a week or 10 days ago before the Floyd injury that they wouldn't have needed someone that much. But I think the Floyd injury shifts that.
Yes. Yeah, certainly. I don't know. I still would have liked them to add like a high leverage arm. And that's so hard to do. It's so hard to find those guys at the trade deadline. And then generally you pay quite a price for them.
Oh, for sure.
And like, how much are you willing to give up for 20 innings down the stretch?
Right. So if you're the Blue Jays, are you willing to give up, you know, let's say, sure, they can make another Jason Grilly type trade for someone who can provide veteran presence and it's not going to cost a lot. That much is a given. Any team can do that. But would you think that it's a good idea for them to contemplate a bigger acquisition where they maybe give up a bit more in the way of prospects, get a bit more in the way of talent?
I'd want somebody with some control.
Right.
But even still, like, you're talking, you know, I don't know, Drew Storen had a year, right? And like, he looked good when they got him. You know,
yeah.
Like, you know, if somebody had traded for Brett Cecil, you know, before this season, they would have thought, wow, we just got one of the best left-handed relievers in baseball. So it's so volatile. Relievers, yeah. Right? Like, it's so uncertain. So, you know, geez, what would you want to do?
I don't think it's a good idea for a team in the Blue Jays position to give up big prospects for a reliever. Yeah. I think it's a good idea to acquire someone, but I think you acquire someone with a chance to bounce back and you save your chips for a bigger acquisition. I mean, whether it's a starter with some control that you could use, whether it's a bat, you know, this offseason when they're going to need to restore four or five positions around the diamond, I think that's what you save your chips for, or you just keep them and use them as big league players. But I don't know if you do that for a deadline reliever.
It's likely to be kind of the Mark Lowe type or the, you know, the Troy Hawkins type, right? Like, you know, a guy that you trust in the, you know, sixth, seventh inning, maybe you don't want him to be your setup man or your closer on a given night.
Right. And I think now the way the Blue Jays bullpen is set up, you have Tapera and Schultz who have options. So you can send them down to AAA if you add someone. The new guy takes over that spot, and you still have those guys on reserve, giving you some depth that you really haven't had for a lot of the season.
Well, you have Cecil and Franklin Morales both coming back. So, you know, those two guys are very likely to be optioned very soon, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
When those two
come
back.
I mean, right. I wonder what they do with Morales, because it's been... He just hasn't been someone they can rely on all season long. But, like you said, if he's back, if he's healthy, he does have a big league. It's easy to forget, right? Because this season, it's all been, okay... He gets that guaranteed $2 million, and he really offers them nothing in the way of production.
Right.
But he has been a good reliever before.
Oh, absolutely. He was a great reliever for the Royals. You know, he's had kind of a decorated history. He tried to start for the Rockies. which didn't go very well. But yeah, no, he's been a very good reliever.
Yeah, so that's something.
Yeah, he's good enough to be, you know, to warrant a $2 million contract. Like,
well, I don't think he was good enough for that, but they gave him one anyway.
He got it.
I think it's pretty clear he wasn't worth $2 million.
He got it. Yeah. One other kind of outside the box idea. How about young Connor Green, who was promoted to AA New Hampshire this week?
Whoa.
That is generally the last stop before you hit the big leagues as a young prospect. As a young prospect type, you're not really moving them to triple. Like, what do you need to see in AAA? A lot of times guys will go straight from AA to the majors. If you wanted a guy with an electric arm,
yeah,
a ton of velocity, some good breaking stuff, somebody that the league isn't familiar with to add to your bullpen, you know, in September, maybe even into the playoffs, why not Connor Green?
So I guess the downer answer to your question would be that you want to develop him as a starter for the long term.
Right.
And by transitioning him to the bullpen, you'd miss the chance to develop him as a starter. But I'm intrigued by the September idea of that.
Yeah.
Because in September, you don't have any minor league games anyway.
No.
So it's, you know, it's not as though you're taking away from his development to have him in the big leagues in September. But to me, that's only a realistic possibility if he goes to AA and pitches really well for 2 months. I mean, if he can do that, then you've got something on your hands in September. Otherwise, if he's scuffling, I don't know if you want to mess with him.
This year in High A Dunedin, Connor Green, 15 starts, a 2.90 ERA, 51 strikeouts in 77 2/3 innings. So not striking a lot of guys out. I don't know if he's a ground ball guy or fly ball guy. They don't really give us those stats for minor league guys. Don't really know what kind of results he's been getting, but he's been getting outs. I can tell you that. Walked 38 77 2/3. So, you know, we'll see what happens when he gets up to AA. I think it's an option. We've seen the Blue Jays, we saw them do it with Aaron Sanchez, who started throughout his minor league career. They brought him up to pitch out of the bullpen. Saw him do it with Marcus Stroman, started throughout his career, brought him up to pitch out of the bullpen. I don't think it's a crazy idea to think that, you know, this is his introduction to the major leagues is going to come in the bullpen, and especially when we're making a playoff push and we really need an electric arm back there.
Yeah, I think would you see it happening before September potentially?
No.
Yeah, because I can't see it happening before then. For a guy who is 21 years old. And I think, too, I mean, we're still getting a sense of how this regime operates. But Anthopoulos, especially at the beginning of last year, was extremely aggressive with guys like Asuna, Sanchez even, making sure that they were Daniel Norris.
Castro.
Yeah, all those guys got shots at the big league level. I expect that we're gonna see that Atkins and Shapiro are a lot more conservative. And when they have a 21-year-old who has 0 innings above, well, who has... actually 25 innings above High A only, that you're not going to see an aggressive time frame for him.
That's the balance. It's the balance of the long term and the short term. The short term is you're trying to win today and you have this group together. This could be these last 3 months, you know, this team could look dramatically different next year, considering, you know, the expiring contracts, Saunders, Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion. There's three of your best hitters who aren't, you know, who aren't committed to your team next year. Do you want to, you know, you have a shot here.
Yep.
To push and win. You know, the Red Sox are falling apart at the seams. Baltimore has been somewhat consistent, but do you trust that starting rotation?
No.
Blue Jays have had great starting pitching, pretty good hitting lately, especially bullpen not so good. Do you take your shot?
Yeah, I think you take your shot. I think it's worth trading prospects for big league pieces this year.
Right.
And I think also if Green goes to AA and he dominates in September, bring him up. You know what?
Yeah.
Other
how much could it hurt his development to do? You know, to log 20 big league innings in the bullpen, learn what the life is like here. Then he starts next year back at, you know, AA or in AAA or whatever, right? But 21 isn't, you know, in Major League Baseball today, like 21 isn't necessarily that young.
Right. I think we're seeing a movement toward younger players, but yeah. This is a guy who had command issues in Dunedin this year, so to expect him to come up and dominate is a tall order.
I think we're seeing a trend towards organizations also wanting to use the bullets that they have in a young pitcher earlier. You know what I mean? Like, why expend some of the, you know, if all these arms are going to fall apart at some point anyway, why spend those bullets in the minors? We could use them in the majors.
And they all fall apart. they do. Yeah. Inevitably.
They sure do. What else have I got on this list? Devin Travis is a guy who fell apart, was put back together, and is now very, very good. He's, you know, I think he was brought up too early. We know that. He was rushed up because Troy Tulowitzki got hurt. So you saw him struggle in that kind of, in those first few games that he was up. But since then, we are seeing a guy that since, let's pick an arbitrary date here of June the 12th, because that's where the zeros in the hit column stop. So let's pick that one. In 14 games since June 12th, Devin Travis has a slash line of 429, 458, 750 for a 1.208 OPS. He has four dingers, six doubles in that time, three walks, just six strikeouts, 59 plate appearances. Pretty good.
It's great. I think he's been playing really, really well for the last 2 weeks, certainly. But really, if you look at his entire big league career, which is short, it's 91 games, but he's a .299 hitter. His on base is approaching .350. His slugging is just a few points shy of .500. So you're looking at a guy who would be among the best offensive second baseman in baseball if he were to continue that for a full season. And hey, it's not like we have a ton of data on Devin Travis. We haven't seen him do this for a full season yet, but what we have seen is a pretty strong indication that he can be a very good everyday second baseman, and that's a pretty huge asset for a team like the Blue Jays.
Yes. The most encouraging thing about Devin Travis is we're seeing the opposite field approach. And when Devin Travis is at his best, he's kind of hitting balls from center field over to the right field line. You can look at his spray chart from 2015, which is like one of the most dramatic things I've ever seen. All of his singles and doubles go the other way, and all of his homers go to the pull side. It's so strange. But like that's where he hits good line drives, is to the, you know, to the opposite field. And he's kind of got that inside out swing that works for him. This year, as I look at it right now, he's had a few more doubles right down the left field line. Not sure what's going on with that, but you still see a few, you know, all a big cluster of singles here and a couple doubles that have gone the other way, and that's what's most encouraging.
Yeah, and for a team that is already going to have to replace its right fielder, its left fielder, its first baseman, and its DH this offseason, to at least have your up-the-middle positions taken care of, where you have Tulowitzki, you have Devin Travis, who really looks like a keeper, you've got Pilar and you've got Martin. At least you've got up the middle. You have to fill in around the corners a little bit, aside from Donaldson, of course. But, you know, he's really looking like someone who can be a core piece of this team as long as that shoulder holds up.
How about that Troy Tulowitzki, who has, since he's been back, he's slugging the ball. We can give him that. Since he's come back, he's got a .676 slugging percentage because he's hit four home runs and two doubles. The batting average and the on-base percentage are not quite where you would expect them to be for his career norms, but he's hitting for power.
Yeah. He's on something like a 25 home run pace now, with the DL stint in there.
Right.
So you're not getting the Coors Field era, the Rockies era Tulo from what we've seen, but he's still an above average offensive shortstop, and you know he's still capable of making good defensive plays out there. So he might not look like a superstar anymore, but he certainly doesn't look like the struggling version of Tulo that we saw early in the season, and he looks like someone who can be a pretty valuable two-way player.
How many shortstops are going to hit 25 home runs? And does May shout as a shortstop this year, I guess? We'll give it to him. Is Correa going to get there?
Marcus Semien's got a lot of power, but he certainly doesn't have the defense that Tulo has.
It's rare.
Yeah.
It's very rare.
You don't see a lot of those guys. I mean, you've got, again, Danny Espinosa has a lot of power, but he doesn't have the... He's not the complete hitter that Tulo has been in his career. So, yeah, I think that... That Tulowitzki's showing something in the last 2 weeks that we really hadn't seen from him as a Blue Jay.
No, not at all, and that's promising. All right, we're going to step away, and after the break, we're going to be joined by Jeff Passan of Yahoo Sports, author of the best-selling book, The Arm. We're going to talk to him about Aaron Sanchez and what the Blue Jays are doing to protect his young arm when we continue on At the Letters.
Sanchez strikes out Frazier, a couple of strikeouts in the inning. Explosive fastball down. Bouncing ball, and Encarnacion takes it. It's a fair ball, and that'll do it.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling here with Ben Nicholson-Smith. We're on sportsnet.ca. We're on iTunes. Please like, share, favorite, and subscribe. Very pleased to be joined on the phone by Jeff Passan, MLB columnist for Yahoo Sports, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. Jeff, how are you?
Gentlemen, how are you?
Good.
Doing well.
We wanted to have you on specifically just to lean on some of the research and reporting, I guess, that you did for this book. It's a great book, by the way. Go to Amazon and pick it up. It's called The Arm. You can find it very easily there. And we wanted to talk to you because here in Toronto, one of the overarching themes of this season has been the Blue Jays' efforts to preserve the arm of one Aaron Sanchez. He's been really the Blue Jays' best starter to this point, and the club has said repeatedly that he'll be moved to the bullpen at some time in the near future. They've been pretty vague in terms of when exactly they'll do that, but you know they've mentioned his innings a lot, and he topped out at 133.1 2 years ago, and they said they don't want to go too far past that. I'm curious in general, what do you think of how the Blue Jays are handling Aaron Sanchez, especially, you know, at the age of 23?
I honestly don't understand it. There is a point at which the little birdie needs to get out of the nest and fly by itself. And the mother can feed it only so long. And we don't know when that point is in baseball. But we also don't know if taking the ultra-conservative approach toward it is going to make him any likelier to stay healthy. And so, if you weigh all of these things, I think it comes to the point where Aaron Sanchez is a much different physically pitcher than he was even a year ago with the weight gain, and he's got more mileage on his arm with the innings that he's thrown in the big leagues. And I'm just wondering, at what point are they going to allow him to just be a starter like a starter's supposed to be? I appreciate that they want to preserve his arm. I've just seen nothing in research, nor have people who do this for a living and study this stuff seen anything to say that putting a guy on an innings limit is any likelier to keep him healthy. I mean, I just had a conversation a couple weeks ago with Jabba Chamberlain about this very subject. He came up to me and he said, hey, Jeff, I love the book. Why the hell wasn't I in it? Because aren't I the poster boy for guys getting toyed around with? And look at what it did to me. And he showed me his elbow, and he's got a big smiley face tattooed on it over his Tommy John scar. So it's not like the Blue Jays can say definitively what we are doing is right for Aaron Sanchez. The only thing, guys, that I think that the only reason I hesitate to be any more critical about this is because maybe they know there is something in his elbow or in his shoulder right now that they're just trying to delay the inevitability for. Maybe there is a partial tear in there. Maybe there's a bone spur, a bone chip, something along those lines. And that lack of information publicly makes us even more speculative, which I think is dangerous. But if we're just going on the assumption that Aaron Sanchez is a relatively healthy 23, about to be 24-year-old pitcher, I don't get it.
Yeah, and based on what we do know, Sanchez is in the rotation for now. He's pitched really well so far this year, and he's going to be in the rotation for some amount of time that remains uncertain. So for as long as he is in that rotation, what is your research showing you about the best ways to keep a pitcher, a young pitcher, healthy and make sure that he does have a future with this team?
You know, I don't know that there's anything. And look, part of the frustration of this book, for readers, I imagine, and for myself personally, is I wish I had more answers. Like, I wish I could tell you this is the type of plan that a 24-year-old pitcher should be on to keep his arm healthy.
Right.
Unfortunately, Aaron Sanchez throws really freaking hard, and guys who throw really freaking hard tend to get hurt at a much higher and more significant rate than guys who don't throw as hard. Now, that doesn't mean Aaron Sanchez is going to get hurt, just as it doesn't mean a guy who sits in 88 isn't going to get hurt. But we're working on probabilities here. I think if I were running the Blue Jays right now, and if I saw Aaron Sanchez's MRI and everything looked as clean as it ought look for a guy who's out there pumping the sort of stuff he does, I absolutely would work in skipped starts. I absolutely would work in extra rest for him, and you'd go and throw Marco Estrada and Marcus Stroman, and particularly R.A. Dickey, more than you would otherwise. I would, if you're going to baby him like that. I just don't understand the logic behind taking a guy out of a role for the sake of innings, when innings are not a great indicator about a guy getting hurt. Aaron Sanchez is going to go into a situation, guys, where he's throwing 98 and 99 every other pitch, or three out of every four pitches, and he's throwing max effort in inning, maybe two at a time. And that, as we have seen in the scarred elbows of many a reliever, is just as potentially injurious as starting is.
Yeah, I was, you know, I've made that point a lot, that innings are really a silly barometer to use. No two innings are alike, and it doesn't, you know, tell you how many pitches a guy threw or how, you know, high stress those pitches were. And I feel like there's so many more modern tools that you can use. You know, there's biomechanics. You can watch a guy's spin rates. You know, you can watch his release point. There's things, you know, there's the sleeves, like the M-throw sleeve you can put on your arm to test a guy. I'm curious if, you know, when you were doing this book, did you determine why more, you know, major league franchises aren't utilizing these tools, or if they are and they just aren't publicly saying that they are?
You know, I think the technology's not quite there yet. I think we are on the cusp of some really great things. And the Kinetrack system, for example, it's been down in Tropicana Field for a year now. And I know of at least one, I think two more major league park installations where it's going on. And it uses cameras to capture data points on all aspects of a pitcher's body. So it gives you essentially live biomechanical markers, only without using the little things, you know, the little dots that they do in typical motion capture. I mean, it's markerless motion capture, and it has a chance to be brilliant once we get a large enough data set and can see, okay, these 50 guys got hurt. What do they have in common? Is it their elbow flexion? Is it the degree at which their shoulder internally or externally rotates? It's all of these wonky things that us pitching nerds love to talk about, but just don't know because there's not strong enough data out there. There's going to be that at some point. We're just a few years away from that now. And so I think the technology needs to get better. And unfortunately, for this generation of pitchers, it's going to be too late. It's the kids like my son, who's 8 years old now. I don't know if he's ever going to be anything because he's a passin', and we're not exactly the most athletic people out there. But if he turns into something, you know, maybe we have a chance to see with him or with a generation of pitchers coming up what technology can give us and how it might be able to save arms.
So one of the reasons that Sanchez has such a relatively small base of innings is that when he first came up, the Blue Jays were extremely cautious with him. You look back at 2010, he started 10 games, pitched 25 innings. And this is something that you spoke to Alex Anthopoulos, of course, the former GM of the Blue Jays, for while writing your book. And I'm wondering, with the benefit of hindsight, looking back at how the Blue Jays handled Sanchez, Noah Syndergaard, Justin Nicolino, what do you think about how Sanchez was brought up through the minor league system?
I mean, I'd like to say that they did a really good job considering that, you know, you just named three healthy guys, but I could go back with you and say they did pretty much the same thing with Drew Hutchison and he blew out. They did pretty much the same thing with Brandon Morrow and he got hurt. They did pretty much the same thing with Roberto Osuna and he got hurt. So, you know, to say that this super conservative method works, I just don't buy it. Here's the thing, guys, about being really conservative with pitchers. And I'm not accusing Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins of this being their motivation, but I do know general managers who have said this to me. If you baby a pitcher, you're not culpable when he gets hurt. And being a GM or a president of a baseball team, it's a great job. And if you can inure yourself from all of these little pitfalls that are surrounding you that you might get blamed for, overworking a pitcher, hiring the wrong manager, you know, whatever it may be. It's the same thing as doing like a teardown rebuild. When you do a teardown, that is essentially 5 years of job security you have just bought yourself right there. And if you say, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that this pitcher doesn't get hurt, and you baby him all the way and he still gets hurt, I mean, you can say, well, we tried to do the right thing with him. And no one's ever going to sit there and say, well, you didn't. Whereas if a guy goes out there like Matt Harvey did last year and pitches more innings than the general expectation these days, if he comes back the next year, what's the narrative? Mets messed up Harvey. What the hell were they thinking? And so I think this is a very safe way to go. I just don't know that it's the right way.
Like a really big takeaway for me from your book was that a lot of times when, you know, a pitcher gets to the major leagues, you know, you can baby him, you can piggyback him, you can do whatever. But a lot of times it's too late because this is a guy who, you know, has thrown a ton during high school or in college, you know, had a youth coach who made him do kind of ridiculous things. You know, is the real solution here that throughout youth baseball and high school baseball and what have you, that there needs to be kind of a paradigm shift to, you know, we're developing pitchers. We're not always, you know, putting winning over everything.
You know, 4 years ago when I started writing this book, I wanted to do it just to show inside of what it was like to come back from Tommy John surgery and tell these stories of Daniel Hudson and Todd Coffey, who've let me follow them around for 3+ years. But as I continued writing and reporting it, more and more the youth aspect became near and dear to me. And my son was 5 at the time when he, you know, when I started doing this, and he's 8 now, and he's pitching this year. And I mean, I'm in a suburb of Kansas City, so I am not in a baseball hotbed by any means. But I saw some untoward things in this league that my kid was pitching in. I mean, I'm the pitching coach on this team, and I had 11 of our 15 kids pitching because I told them, you need to pitch because it's going to keep your teammate healthy. And whereas there was really no pitch limit in the league, just I think it was a 3-inning limit, we limited our kids to 30 pitches a game because they're 8, 9, and 10 years old. I saw a kid throw 100 pitches over 30 innings one time, and he just, I mean, he was walking the bases loaded and walking in runs, and I wanted to go over to the bench of the other coach and say, what the hell is wrong with you? But I got pulled away by the head coach, unfortunately, because that probably would have started a fight, and I don't want to be that guy. I just see these things and see, you know, these tournaments where kids are pitching twice a day and 3 times over 2 days and 4 times over 3 days. I see the College World Series where the coaches on both sides are just abusing these kids. I see it in high school. I wrote a column a couple weeks ago on a kid who threw 157 pitches in a game as a junior in high school, and he's a D1 recruit, and his dad was the assistant coach. I see all these things, and I think to myself, this is why I needed to write this book, because over the next 10 years, this needs to change. There needs to be more awareness, and hopefully it does.
With this being a CBA year, do you think that those changes could start to happen sooner rather than later, as far as maybe a bit more communication between, say, Major League Baseball and youth baseball or college baseball? Is that something you could see in the relatively near future?
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to be a collective bargaining thing, though. I think that's something that USA Baseball needs to really take a hold of. And Major League Baseball has empowered USA Baseball, which in the past, to me, has been a fairly feckless organization. They've been there to select youth teams and like the World Baseball Classic team. And, they've done well in that respect, but that's more because America is a pretty big powerhouse when it comes to youth baseball. What they need to do is Major League Baseball, whether it's through USA Baseball or otherwise, needs to take control of a youth apparatus run amok. It's bad when professional baseball, the place where guys used to throw 200 pitches a game, is now the safest place for an arm. I mean, I really do believe that.
Yeah.
It is the safest place. And guys are going to blow out because they're throwing hard and because they've got the wear and tear built up. But I would rather have my kid under the auspices of a major league team, even a conservative one. It's almost backward at this point, guys, where the levels that should be ultra-conservative are ridiculously liberal with pitch counts. And in the major leagues where we have grown men and their bodies are more equipped to handle it, we've pulled the rein back so far that guys like Clayton Kershaw and Madison Bumgarner, who I'm convinced could go out there and throw 125 pitches and be okay every game, once we get to triple digits, you know, it's like the red terror flag goes off.
What is it that makes those guys okay to throw that many pitches every fifth day? Is it just something unique in their genetics or the way they've been handled in their careers? What would you say?
You know, I think it's more my confidence that if you reach a certain age and have not been injured, you're sort of past that injury nexus. And there may be that you know, fear with the Blue Jays. I mean, the age of 25 tends to be that threshold. And look, you got guys like Bronson Arroyo and Cliff Lee whose arms die in their 30s, and a guy like Homer Bailey, who I believe blew out at 27 years old and still isn't back at this point. So there are exceptions to the rule, but by and large, if you reach the, you know, your mid to late 20s and you haven't gotten hurt yet, you're probably going to be in pretty good shape. You may have attrition of stuff like we've seen with Verlander, Felix Hernandez, but a guy like John Lester is throwing as well as he ever has. And that's saying something considering he's in his early 30s at this point and on that exorbitant contract with the Cubs.
Yeah, it's interesting with Sanchez and with, of course, Noah Syndergaard, who's now dealing with a bone spur. These guys are still really young, and they haven't gotten to that age 25 level. They throw really hard. Generally speaking, and, you know, like you said, without seeing the MRIs, it's hard to know with these two specific pitchers. But in general, if you have a young guy who throws really hard, what kind of risk are they at of getting Tommy John?
Let's put it this way. If you have a young guy who throws really hard and he doesn't have Tommy John surgery, he's lucky. And by really hard, I'm talking fastball sitting 96, 97, 98. And there aren't a whole lot of guys who do that. But, you know, if you look at the velocity leaderboard guys on Fangraphs or Brooks Baseball, wherever it may be, pretty much every one of the starters has had Tommy John surgery. Yeah. You know, Garrett Richards is going through stem cell right now. He may not need it. But Strasburg and Harvey and Fernandez, it's almost like Noah Syndergaard's the only one, and there's a chance he's going to need surgery anyway. And the first time your elbow gets cut, you are significantly more likely going forward to have another type of injury. And look, as a baseball fan, I pray like hell that Noah Syndergaard's elbow holds up. And I pray like that Aaron Sanchez's elbow holds up. Because these are guys who are fun to watch. They're dynamic arms. They know what they're doing. They're talented. It's enjoyable to watch Aaron Sanchez pitch right now. And it's going to be far less enjoyable to see him do it for one inning at a time.
You know, when I think about all this, I wonder if there isn't just kind of a catch-22 at the heart of all this when you think about velocity in this game. Because, you know, the more velocity you throw with, the more effective as a pitcher you are, the more guys you can strike out. But the more velocity you throw with, the more stress you put on your arm, your elbow, your shoulder, your ligaments. And, you know, when you really boil it down, it's pretty unnatural to throw a 5-ounce ball 100 times at 95 miles an hour every 5 days. So, and I think about kids at showcases and all-star games and things like this who, you know, see this horde of scouts with radar guns, and why wouldn't they try to throw as hard as they can? But, you know, that's what'll give them their career. But at the same time, isn't that kind of what could eventually take away their career too?
Yeah, I mean, it's a catch-22. And you've got people out there, you know, advertising at 5 to 7 miles per hour to your fastball and 2 months, and I just see that, and I think it's gross. And I've had this conversation with Kyle Bodie, who I think, honestly, is one of the smartest people in all of baseball. I think he's brilliant. I appreciate the research that he puts into pitching and mechanics. He has a lab up in Seattle called Driveline Baseball, and he trains a bunch of major league players. But he's a velocity-hungry parasite, and I have called him that, and he wears the badge with honor because he knows velocity works. And what he's trying to do is to marry velocity and health. And that's a really difficult thing to do, and the first guy or woman who figures that out is going to be freaking rich. It's why the Dodgers have an entire think tank devoted to this, and why they're running studies on pitchers right now. It's why other organizations are doing the same thing, not quite at the same level of investment, but really devoting time and resources, because the first team that figures out how to keep starting pitching healthy is going to win a bunch of World Series. That to me is like the holy grail at this point. Can you develop starting pitchers and keep them healthy? Can you either figure out the secret sauce? Can you understand the biomechanics better than everyone else? Can you target pitchers who are less likely to get hurt? I mean, whatever it may be, I don't know. And I wish I did, because I would be sipping a margarita on my own private island somewhere.
Well, Jeff, we commend your pursuit of the Holy Grail. We encourage everybody to go on Amazon and purchase The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. You can follow Jeff on Twitter, at Jeff Passan, and there's a way there to get a link directly to buy The Arm, which I encourage everybody to do, and read his stuff at Yahoo Sports. Jeff, thank you so much for coming along.
Thanks, Jeff.
Pleasure's always mine, boys. Appreciate you having me.
Ripped to right field by Melky. Anderson shows off the speed. Eaton on his way to third. It's 2-0 Sox.
I felt like I kept the ball on the ground for the most part, besides maybe one or two pitches. I felt like when they were beating me, it was on the ground in holes. I felt like I got a good amount of ground outs. So I was back down in the zone. Velocity felt better. Just take a positive out of this and work. But I definitely felt a lot better than last outing.
It continues on At The Letters, third segment bonus for you iTunes subscribers. At least I hope you're subscribing on iTunes. If you're listening to the podcast and you're not subscribing on iTunes, what are you even doing with your life?
It's true. If you're listening to this on the radio, you're missing it. You're not
hearing this on the radio. Our thanks to Jeff Passan, who everybody heard on the radio and on the podcast. Interesting thoughts, basically just blowing up the Blue Jays plans for Aaron Sanchez.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it is interesting. And I could see the case where you space it out, you give him some rest when he needs it, right, and you milk more innings out of him in the course of the season.
I've essentially been saying all along, like, if you don't see any tangible changes in velocity and spin rate and all the ways you have to measure this stuff right now, if you're just going off of just innings, what are you even doing?
He's one of your five best starters. Taking him out of the rotation makes your rotation worse.
The interesting thing that Jeff brought up was, well, maybe they know something about what's in his elbow right now or what's in his shoulder. And that, you know, that's something I hadn't actually considered, but maybe that does kind of explain. They're just trying to delay something that they know was in there.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because even with, you see the bone spur stuff leaking out with the Mets, they didn't want that out there.
No.
And it got out there and now they're acknowledging it. But you wonder how much stuff on all these pitchers is, and hey, I mean, you can pitch with a partial tear, you can pitch with a bone spur, but you wonder how much stuff is on these pitchers' arms that we don't even know about.
Well, you talk to, like, you know, doctors and surgeons and stuff, and they'll say if you open up any major league pitcher's arm, any major league pitcher's elbow, you'll find something. You know, you'll find bone spurs, you'll find, you know, tears, you'll find, you know, a lot of times you'll hear, yeah, a guy went in for arthroscopic surgery to kind of clean it up. It's like, what does that mean? You're just cleaning up some of the frayed tendon and some of the, you know, the bone chips that could be in there. Like, you're always going to find something. So, you know, and who knows? Aaron Sanchez is a guy who was a shortstop in high school. You know, he was a guy who didn't really start pitching until his senior year and then was absolutely babied by the Blue Jays, as we talked about, throughout the minor leagues. So it would be interesting if there was something in there.
Yeah, no, it would be for sure. But great book by Jeff, and would definitely recommend it. He does not pull punches, that Jeff Passan. He definitely goes after youth baseball, and he calls it like he sees it.
So yes,
it's a very good read.
No, it's an important book, and I think that, you know, even, you know, he told the Jobby Chamberlain story. You know, people in the game are reading this book and respecting it, and, you know, carrying it forward
for sure.
So our thanks to Jeff. Insightful stuff. Let's talk about Marcus Stroman. We talked about him last week at length, and I don't know if too much has changed, but I mean, is there any, you know, what to you, where are you now this week versus last week?
Just to reiterate, I mean, I think that he's still one of their five best starters, so I think you give him more shots. And that doesn't mean he isn't in definite leash, but I think that you give him a couple more shots, you see where he's at, and you go from there.
Here's the thing. Like, a lot of people say, oh, send him down. What's wrong with sending him down? You know, he's got to learn his lessons. You know, send him to the major leagues. Roy Halladay went to the minor leagues. You have to say more than send him to the minor leagues. You have to say, okay, here's what he's going to go down there and work on. And here's who he's going to work on it with. And here's the adjustments that he's going to try to make.
And here's who's going to replace him. You know, that's the big thing. And I know everyone points to Hutchison, but let's face it, it's not like the Blue Jays have, you know, let's say I know he's dealing with a bone spur now, but Steven Matz or Noah Syndergaard last year with the Mets just knocking on the door. They don't have that. So you're dealing with someone in Drew Hutchison who's probably a back-end big league starter.
Yes, exactly. And the point I was making was that if you don't have adjustments for him to make and you don't have actual, like, tangible differences that you want to see and things you want him to work on, then it's really just a shot to his confidence. It's a demoralizing thing. It's an embarrassing thing. It's really not doing anything good for him. Like, there's no positive from that. It's not like, you know, you every guy reacts to demotions the same way. It's not like you get demoted and all of a sudden, oh, now I am humbled and now I will pitch better all of a sudden magically. Give them something to work on.
Yeah.
Like that, that's the thing. Like you need to have more than that. And who, where do you have your best coaches? In the major league level. Pete Walker is like tireless when it comes to looking at video, looking at mechanics, looking at deliveries. Tireless when it comes to this stuff. I guarantee you those guys have been working for hours on it. You want him to go to AAA where he's going to be working with a new coach that he hasn't worked with all year, a guy who's not familiar with his mechanics, with his delivery, with any of that. That's your plan to fix him?
Yeah, and I would say that would be a justifiable plan only if you thought that Stroman was falling apart at the seams.
Doesn't stand to benefit from it.
Right, and you've seen enough from him as far as stuff, as far as even results early in the year, that one or two more starts, give him another look, extend that rope a little bit, because I think that there's a chance he could turn it around before too long.
His last time out, 5 innings pitched, 4 earned runs. Like, that's not atrocious.
It's not good.
It's not great, but he wasn't laughed out of the yard.
No, I mean, it's not a good start.
What'd Jay Happ do last night, right? Like, 6 innings pitched, 4 earned runs, right?
It wasn't a good start either.
Yeah.
Stroman didn't pitch particularly
well. The expectation that he's going to throw a shutout every time out.
I think the expectation is that he's going to be a capable big league starter, which he has not been for the last 8 starts. But that doesn't mean he can't be one going forward.
I think there's this idea that every major league team other than the Blue Jays has 5 guys who go out and pitch really, really well every time they go out.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Not the case.
Look at the Red Sox.
Oh, man.
Eduardo Rodriguez had like a mental breakdown on the mound the other night. Right?
I was
like,
bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guy was crying on the mound. Like,
I missed what?
Yeah. Absolutely. Wow. Dustin Pedroia came out and screamed at him. His pitching coach came out and chewed him out. Like, Farrell came out. Like, there was a point where Xander Bogaerts was like looking into the dugout at John Farrell, like, when are you going to come get this guy?
Wow.
It's because the guy was just like, was just breaking down. So it's not like every, you know, you can't expect every pitcher, especially a young pitcher, just be great every time out. Marcus Stroman has been great in 2 of his last 7 starts. There was, you know, and against Phillies and the Twins, whatever, major league hitters. He got him out. He was good against them.
He's
really,
been bad.
Really good.
It's been a bad 8 starts. To me, it's just there's a chance he'll be better.
I don't think it's been as bad as people are making it out to be.
It's been pretty bad.
What I know has been bad are our over-unders from earlier this year.
Yep.
Speak of seamless transitions. We had a request on Twitter to update the over-unders at the halfway mark. And yeah, we're going to fulfill that request because it seems like a fun thing to do. So let's just pick out the ones where Ben and I disagreed. There's a lot of them that where we did agree. We'll let those be.
We'll post them. We'll post every update in the article.
One of us will.
Yes.
Probably not me.
Well, they're going to be there.
Ben will get those in there for you. Let's pick out a few where we disagreed. Kevin Pillar on base percentage. We set the over-under at 326. I'm not entirely sure. I don't really remember what we based that on. I don't know if that's weighted last year or his career average. It might have been the average for center fielders or who knows. Sam is in my ear saying that's what it was. Regardless, his on-base percentage today is 290, which is well below 326.
Looks like I'm coming out ahead on that one.
Ben had the under. I had the over. There's still time. Still time. I would be concerned that there's another one of those Kevin Pillar funks in our future that would be affecting that. To this point, he has 8 walks on the season and 318 plate appearances. It's just not going to walk.
No.
That's Kevin Pillar. Like, I feel like part of what makes him able to hit at this level is being aggressive and swinging at everything. And I think it's kind of like the gift and the curse type of thing where what allows him to be what he is that he swings a lot.
And overall, he's got an OPS around 700. I mean, it's not a banner offensive season, but he's giving you enough that when it's paired with his defense, he's certainly a very valuable player.
Second most hits on the team behind Josh Donaldson. He has more hits than Michael Saunders, more than Edwin Encarnacion. Tied for the team lead in doubles with Michael Saunders. That's okay.
Yeah, he's a below average offensive player and a well above average defensive player.
It's funny that you can be a below average offensive player and have the second most hits on the team.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No, I mean,
it's funny that you can have those two things concurrently.
Well, one of the things that Pillar does well is he stays on the field. And that's one of the reasons that he's got a lot of hits. I mean, he's avoided the DL despite his very aggressive style of play.
Another one was J-Hap ERA. We set the over-under at 4. The actual J-Hap ERA today after his start last night in Colorado was 3.70. I had the over. Ben had the under. His ERA has gone up since the beginning of the year.
It has.
I need it to go up another 0.31 points.
Yeah.
To win this one.
I think he's been kind of, when you look at the entire season, this is about where we thought he would be. And I think that going forward, it's pretty reasonable to expect an ERA around 3.7. Maybe it's around 4, but somewhere in that range. I'm feeling good about this one.
Yeah, we haven't really seen prolonged struggles from J-Hop. We see an off start here and there, but he's been pretty good at bouncing back from them. So we'll see. R.A. Dickey's strikeouts. We had the over-under set at 125. Currently, he is at 66. I had taken the over. Ben took the under. He's at 66, and he's basically halfway through his season.
So you're looking good.
So I'm looking okay. Like, I'm looking like I'm going to win by a hair.
Yeah, he's on pace for about 130, 135 at this point. So, you know, you can't afford too many zero or one strikeout games. But one of the weird things is Dickey has actually had a few starts this year where the knuckler has really been dancing. And even if he's throwing, you know, a few wild pitches in there, a couple pass balls, he still has gotten a lot of strikeouts on a handful of occasions.
Hey, even if Josh Tolley's going to drop and the guy's going to reach first base, I'll still take that strikeout.
Just chances for more strikeouts that way.
Right. Just chances for more Ks. Speaking of Josh Tolley, Josh Tolley home runs we had set at 1.5. And I believe that we set this one after he had already hit his one home run in Tampa Bay off Drew Smyly.
So the question was he going to hit one home run the rest of the way? And this is like with 160 games remaining or something.
It's so mean. So yeah, he's still at one. As we know, Josh Tolley has struggled mightily at the plate. He's currently carrying a slash line of 111, 211, 159 through his 73 plate appearances. I mean, I'm just hoping he runs into one, really. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I'm feeling really strong about this one. I think that, you look at Tolley and what he's been able to do offensively, it's been a struggle for him since that one home run. I think to say the least, as Sam pointed out, as we were about to record here, Tolley also has one RBI on the season as we approach the halfway point.
Last year, he had two. So he's almost tied his mark from last year. Like, look, Josh Tolley is obviously not a very good offensive player.
Right.
I don't know. Like, could he be this bad? Because this is like, these are way, way career lows by a mile.
Yeah, I think that he's probably got a few more singles and a few more walks in his future. Yeah. You know, home runs, I don't think they're coming his way.
One more home run.
Well,
that's all I need.
That's all you need. I don't know if you're going to get it.
Feeling a bit better about this one. Michael Saunders home runs, we had set it at 19.5. Basically, will Michael Saunders get to 20? He's currently at 15. I had taken the over. Ben, you've little faith, took the under.
Yeah. Yeah, good call.
Not looking too good right now,
bud. Good call. It's a good call so far.
Need five more over the back half of the season.
Yeah, that's on the pace he's at. He'll get that next month.
Absolutely. The biggest thing is I just need him to stay on the field. If he gets hurt, that's the only thing I think that could damage my chances of winning that one.
And so far, he's shown that he can play through nagging injuries.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I feel good about believing in Michael Saunders. Even last year when, you know, he was out the entire year and you know, people are saying, oh, this guy's been what a waste, you know, get rid of him, release him. Who's going to play left field for us in 2016, this and that. I was like, no, Michael Saunders is good. He's going to be fine. And he has been. Feel good about that.
No question. No question.
Feel good. Troy Tulowitzki games played. We set the over under at 129.5. Ben took the over. I took the under. He's currently at 55 games played.
Yeah. And the Jays have played 79. So he's missed 24. And, you know, where we set the over under, that means he can essentially miss one more week and that's it. So you're looking really good on this one. And I'll say it's probably a wise call on your part to bet against Tulowitzki's health. I mean, seriously. And he's showing signs of productivity, as we talked about, but health has not been his calling card in the course of his career.
Yes, feeling good about my bet against Troy Tulowitzki. I feel like we might be making that over under on many future years of ACL.
He's here for a while. He is here for a while.
The next one was Josh Donaldson to Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista homers combined. We said at 120.5 because they hit 120 last year, I guess. I took the over. Ben took the under. Currently, they are at 50, I want to say.
Yep.
It's not looking too good for me.
No, not looking good. You're going to need 70 in the second half, essentially. That's a lot of home runs in the second half.
That's a lot of home runs. Yeah, I need a lot more games at Coors Field.
I'm winning that one.
And I need Jose Bautista to be in the lineup, which he very much is not going to be until after the All-Star break.
Yeah. The next one's interesting, though.
So that's not good. The next one is the final one. Contract extensions. We set the over-under at 0.5. any contract extension, like it could have been anybody on the team, not just like the big names, anybody. Currently there have been zero. I took the over, Ben took the under.
Yeah, it's tough to do in the second half of the season too, because once these guys get very close to free agency, at a certain point it's like, well, the market's 8 weeks away. Do you really want to forego the chance at a big payday just by waiting or by signing 8 weeks beforehand?
Yeah, my last hope is that they make some sort of like minor announcement at the All-Star break for somebody. But I don't
Smoke
even know
who. 2-year deal, you know, right? Something like that.
Yeah, like something along those lines. Jesus Montero, 10-year extension.
AAA All-Star.
AAA All-Star, Jesus Montero. AAA All-Star, Drew Hutchison, Dustin Andelin. And there was another name in there.
Ben Rowan.
Ben Rowan, the guy with the funky, he looks like he's bowling when he throws the ball. Going to the All-Star game. Ben Rowan.
That team has some players that I'm sure we will see up here at the big league level before that long.
One or two. We've already seen quite a few of them. And that's that. So there's your update for the over-unders. Not looking good for me. But what are you going to do?
Not so far.
You know what? I swung for the fences. I took some chances. All right. Ben took the safe picks. Went the safe route. He protected Aaron Sanchez's arm. I said, nah, just let him pitch. That's what I did.
Well, I'm saying it's fine to let Sanchez pitch. There's no opposition there.
There's opposition in the Blue Jays front office.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
And on the Blue Jays coaching staff as well. It's going to happen, John Gibbons keeps saying. It's going to happen. I think John Gibbons really wants it to happen because he would like somebody who can pitch in the eighth inning.
That much is clear. They need some solutions there.
Absolutely. So that's it for us. Thanks for coming along on At The Letters. Thanks to producer Sam McKee, who had to do yeoman's work this week, at Sam A. McKee on Twitter. Ben's at B. Nixon Smith on Twitter. I'm at Arden Zwelling on Twitter. Please like, share, favorite, subscribe to the podcast. Do all that good stuff. Hit us up if you've got any feedback. That's it for us. Thanks for coming along. This has been At The Letters.